Welcome to this week's edition of the Bibliopod, Maclean's Books Podcast. I'm Anne Kingston.
I'm Brian Bethune.
This week, we explore the arrival of the new marriage plot in fiction. I'll talk with two writers who have recently published critically acclaimed novels depicting marriages in inventive ways, Lauren Groff, the author of Fates and Furies, and Leah McLaren, the author of A Better Man. And Brian will talk to Timothy Snyder, the Yale University historian and author of Black Earth, a groundbreaking and controversial new book about the Holocaust. The marriage plot is an academic term used to describe novels about courtship rituals and the obstacles thrown in the way of young couples on the way to matrimony. Think Jane Austen, Samuel Richardson, George Eliot. Invariably, these stories ended at the altar. Recently, however, we've seen the emergence of a liberated marriage plot, a focus on what happens after the wedding. These are books that explore the complexities and duplicities involved in contemporary marriage, often using dual or alternating narratives to tell the tale, as seen in The Silent Wife and Gillian Flynn's Gone Girl. Today we'll be investigating this trend with the authors of two recently published and highly recommended novels about long-standing marriages told from dual vantage points. Lauren Groff, the author of Fates and Furies, published this month, joins us from Gainesville, Florida. Leah McLaren, the author of A Better Man, which was released earlier this year, joins us from her home in London. Welcome to the Bibliopod, both of you.
Thank you for having me.
So, Lauren, we'll start this conversation with you. Your book, Fates and Furies, tracks a 24-year marriage, which is seen from the outside as golden. We meet Lotto and Matilda hours after their impetuous wedding, having sex on a beach in Maine. And at the very beginning of the book, you talk in terms of marriage as almost a third element. And to quote you, you say, even still a third person, their marriage had slid in. What was it about investigating marriage that intrigued you as a subject?
Well, marriage is absolutely fascinating, right? It's this incredibly intimate internal space that's also in its own way a little bit performative. It's something that we do for other people's eyes as well. And I love that ambiguity in the term. I also have my own deep-seated ambivalence about marriage as an institution itself, which is dependent on a lot of thoughts about the historical situation of marriage. But in truth, it's just a tremendously fascinating subject. I mean, you can look at the history of the novel as sort of tracing an individual through time and space within constraints, right? And the biggest constraints, the ones that we all tend to share, are birth and death, you know, family, money, and marriage contains all of those things within it.
I want to explore that in a minute. I just wanted to bring Leah into the conversation. Your book, A Better Man, looks at a troubled 10-year marriage between characters Nick and Maya. They're affluent. They have what everybody is told to want, which is, a marriage, success, money, great house, two kids. They're sort of this privileged pair. Yet, everything looks good, but it's not. You are looking inside this kind of insular bubble that is created. I mean, we are told through advertising conduits and so forth that marriage is a sort of an aspirational goal and all of the trappings of it, which is something you explore. What was it about the dark side that drew you?
I think that Lauren's comment about marriage being both intimate and performative certainly gets to the heart of what I was trying to write about in A Better Man, which is about a marriage. It's about a guy who seemingly has this perfect life, but he wants to leave his wife, and so he goes to a lawyer and essentially asks him how much it's going to cost him. And like most people who want to leave, affluent men who want to leave their wives who perhaps don't work, their dependent wives, he's told that it will cost him a lot of money, so he decides, and this is apparently a thing, according to my family lawyer friends, he decides to pretend to be the perfect husband for about 6 months before he actually files for divorce, i.e. encourages his wife to go back to work, spends more time with the kids so that he can get joint custody and not have to pay equalization payments, takes her on holiday, just to sort of mitigate the anger that would come when he finally does leave. So I was fascinated by the idea, and in the process of doing so, it changes his character. So I was interested in the idea of, what if you were a shitty husband and you pretended to be a good husband. Would pretending, what if you're just a bad person and you pretend to be a good person, does it make you a good person? I'm fascinated by that idea of how much of a good marriage is just two people pretending, giving each other their best selves, sort of faking it to make it, and how much of it is a natural, organic thing.
Well, that's a fascinating point that actually resonates in terms of Lauren's book, because it's about the construction of a narrative, the extent to which the way we understand, I mean, there's the cliche about marriage is that it's a mystery even to people within it, and there is therefore this construction of narrative. So I'm wondering, Lauren, in terms of your own book, the dual, you have two narratives, so Leah's book also alternates between the chapters, alternate, in your case it's half and half, the book is divided.
So the book is, you're right, constructed in two separate parts, and the first part was Lotto, the husband's part, and he's sort of this golden, charismatic person who, in that part of the book, everybody thinks Mathilde's function is as a fairly traditional wife, you know, the support staff to this grand ego of Lotto's. And then in the second half, you sort of see things from her point of view. It is a construction of a narrative, and I think we all go around our lives constructing our own narratives on what's happening at the moment. And within a marriage, I think probably there are two very, very different narratives happening because there are two individuals who are living the marriages at the time. Even in the most loving marriage, and I wanted to write a book that was about a happy marriage because it seems to me fairly rare to find a book about a happy marriage. And in fact, I can only think of one model of a happy marriage, and it's in Anna Karenina, and it's Levin and Kitty, you know?
Yeah, I think that the point about the individual point of view, which, you know, figures so much in modern fiction, and how that's translated into the way we interpret marriage or present marriage. I mean, once upon a time, back in the days of Jane Austen, when marriage was this contractual exchange of commodities or, you know, an economic exchange understood that way, whereas today it's this idea of soulmates and we think in terms of personal happiness as being a goal, which is at odds in a sense with the fundamental underpinnings of the way we see traditional marriage anyway. And it's certainly in Leah's book a definite friction, this idea of what a marriage is versus what the individual wants.
Well, yeah, it's that tension too between personal happiness and, you know, the projection of happiness, and marriage really gets to the heart of all of that, doesn't it? Because it's, people often talk about, you know, if you go on Facebook, people will put up, these are my parents, married for 50 years today, they are an inspiration to me, a successful marriage. And you look at that picture of people married 50 years and you think, well, that's success. But it's bizarre because you don't know anything about it. For all you know, they could have been stabbing each other with broken beer bottles for 50 years, but they're still married. So that is success in our society. So
hanging in there.
I've been married twice now, and when I had to divorce my first husband, I did it here in the UK, and it doesn't matter why, but I had to do it quickly, and I actually we had to petition the court and make a very strong case for our divorce. And the judge sent it back twice because the way I wanted to get divorced was, you know, we were married for a while, now we want different things. Thank you. Can we please just have our divorce paper? And the court took a view that, no, marriage is a social good. It's an important contract. You two entered into it. You make the argument for why we should give you a divorce. And it shocked me, and it made me realize, my God, this really is bigger than us. This really is. You know, there's a reason why it is a legally binding institution. And at least it made me also realize quite shamefully that the court took a very different view of marriage than I did at that time in my life.
Well, yes, I mean, that's actually a perfect example of the friction. And going back to Lauren's point the line in the beginning of the book about this third between them, that, you know, the marriage and very much in Fates and Furies, a happy marriage, which is also a book about creativity and creation and artistic creation. The marriage is in a sense something that's created between the two of them as well. And in a way, it almost seems elemental to that, the happiness of the marriage, that they shared this vision in a way. I don't know if that's a correct interpretation or what you think about that idea, Lauren, of the third and creating it within a marriage.
That is absolutely, in my vision, that's the way that I had written the book. And it's so funny, that's the first time anybody's brought it up, and I'm so glad that you did. Thank you. You construct this a narrative that actually becomes its own almost person, and Leah's story exactly exemplifies what we're thinking of. It, suddenly, there's this thing that we create, and becomes bigger than the two individuals within it, and it becomes a social construct that is really, really hard to take apart, even though it's created only out of nothing, really, right? It's created only out of the human hearts involved in it, which are not material. It becomes
true.
Its own almost child. You know, it becomes a human almost in its own way, and its own idiosyncratic thing, which is fascinating.
Well, especially the narrative of it almost becomes the agreement on a narrative. You know, in your book, Lauren, it's that idea of many couples make this sort of tacit agreement of the story of how they met, and that story may or may not be true, and who knows what the real story is. But even I've often noticed in the unraveling of marriages, there will often be a great struggle between two people on agreeing why they're breaking up or agreeing on what went wrong. This need, I find it fascinating in a marriage, it somehow becomes very important to married couples to agree on the narrative of who they are and why they are. And if they can't agree, that is often where fascinating problems and drama occurs, isn't it?
That's fascinating. In fact, I read a study that said that one of the predictors of a happy marriage is that both couples sort of have the same story or share the same story about how they met. And also, it's also, I find it very telling, just even talking to people, when you ask them how they met as a couple, how they tell the story really is a kind of a barometer of how happy they are within the marriage.
True.
I want to talk to you about storytelling. You both used the dual narrative going back and forth in different ways. Could you speak a bit about that? It does seem to be something that's happening a lot in books about marriage.
I couldn't really think of any other way to write about the sort of intricacy of a marriage. I did find it helpful to sort of get inside the head of the marriage, and certainly inside the head of the husband, Nick, in my book, who is not a character who I share some characteristics in common with Maya, the wife, but with Nick, I couldn't have known that marriage without actually trying to write him from the inside. And actually, in the process of writing it, I found his character much easier to write.
And Lauren?
I was trying really hard to ask a lot of questions about traditional roles within a marriage or assumptions within a marriage and things that I myself bridle against in my own marriage, which, you know, even though I am ambivalent about the institution, I'm very deeply happily married. So there's a strange relationship to it in my own heart. So my structure was a sort of questioning of the institution itself, at least.
I want to end then maybe on that note, because we're at an interesting juncture socially, and maybe the literature is trying to reflect this in different ways. For instance, I mean, marriages, numbers of people marrying are apparently on the decline. At the same time, we're seeing all of this advocacy for marriage rights, and with the recognition that marriage is not simply, going back to Leah's point, it's not simply this, you know, easy thing to get in and out of. It's a social contract. It's a community bond. It speaks, you know, being a husband or a wife is a singular role. I'd like you to hear your thoughts about that. Marriage still is kind of it for absolute social statements about love.
Absolutely. It is something that I feel as if we're not questioning enough. you know, I'm all for the rights of everyone to be married, but at the same time, what really is marriage and how has it changed through the centuries? That's a fascinating thing to actually think about.
That was Leah McLaren, author of A Better Man, and Lauren Groth, author of Fates and Fury.
Timothy Snyder is an American historian, a professor at Yale University, and an authority on the Holocaust. His latest work is Black Earth. It offers, for North Americans, a very different look at how the Holocaust unfolded and what it should mean to us, a focus caught in the book's subtitle, The Holocaust as History and Warning. I'll go right into the fact that in a book full of arresting facts and sentences, you open with a question that should shake up our view of the established vision of the Holocaust. After mentioning the familiar image of the Jews scrubbing the sidewalks of Vienna, you ask, why were the Jews of Austria sent to Belarus, 1,000 kilometers away, to be killed when there was evident Jew hatred in Vienna? That's something that I believe shakes up our view of. Why is that?
The simple answer is that the humiliation of the Jews, the degradation of the Jews, was not part of a process which had to lead to their death. Our story about the Holocaust is of this slow downward slope from discrimination, segregation, stigmatization, separation, concentration, and finally death. That's not actually what happened. What happened is that the Germans learned from 1938 forward that the way to dispose of the Jews was to dispose of political entities, was to destroy states. And so Austrian Jews were not, in fact, murdered in Austria. They were not, in fact, murdered in Germany after Austria was joined to Germany. When they were murdered, they were dispatched eastward to places like Minsk, where German force had already destroyed the state, and that where entirely new sorts of murderous techniques were possible.
Right. You are also the only historian I've read who mentions, both as a fact and as a bitter irony, what the Jews were scrubbing off the sidewalk. Austria, which is their former protection.
It's absolutely crucial to the whole story, but it doesn't fit the major narrative, and therefore no one notices it. It's this piece of evidence which is right in front of our noses, but we don't see it because it's not what we want to see. Right. What was happening in March 1938 was that the governing regime in Austria was planning a referendum on the existence of the Austrian state. And the electoral propaganda was one word, just the word Austria. When the Austrian leaders gave in and allowed Germany to invade instead, what Jews scrubbed off the street was not dirt. They scrubbed off that particular word. They were stigmatized. They were associated with the Austrian state that was passing. This allowed the rest of the Austrian population to associate all of the history of Austria with the Jews, to separate themselves from the Jews. This was a political maneuver which allowed the past to be rewritten.
Right. Almost all the Jewish victims of the Holocaust were not German, and most victims never saw a camp. That, again, is something that stops us in our normal evaluation of what happened. Like, the mass shooting came first in ever more innovative ways. You have the story of the man who invented the lie one victim on top of the other victim strategy.
So historians should start from two very simple techniques. The first technique is chronology. Right. So when I write about the Holocaust, I try to make sure people understand in what circumstances Jews were first killed. This is very important. They weren't first killed in Germany. They weren't even first killed in Poland in 1939. They were first killed when Germany invades the Soviet Union in 1941. So Jews had been oppressed already for 8 years. Jews had been in ghettos in Poland for almost 2 years before the murder actually starts. And the murder starts at the moment of this terrible confrontation where Germany is trying to destroy the Soviet Union and blaming Soviet power on the Jews. The second place for history, the second technique that historians have to use is to pay attention to space. The Holocaust is almost always narrated inside Germany as a bit of German history. I don't do that. I narrate the Holocaust from the perspective of Jews where they happen to live, which was almost entirely outside Germany. Only about 3% of the victims of the Holocaust were German Jews. So if we want to have a sense of how the Holocaust began, how it was experienced, how it pressed forward towards total extermination, we have to pay much, much more attention to Jews beyond Germany. So in this way, I'm doing the reverse of what's been typically done. But I think the reasons for it are very strong.
Right. I mean, if you rank the killing fields, it goes from the place where the state was destroyed twice to where it was destroyed once through allies with damaged territory through ordinary, and you end up in Denmark.
Yeah, this is totally right, and you've understood the narration perfectly. Normally, the way this is narrated is that Germany becomes some kind of overwhelming state, and therefore overpowers its citizens and discriminates against them and can kill them and so on. That is not the most important part of what happens. The most important part of what happens is rather the removal of political authority. And the removal of political authority, the key moment there, is in 1939, the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, when Germany and the Soviet Union decide together to do away with the European order, to destroy four states together, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, and Poland. So at that moment, the European order, the peace order of Europe, is effectively gone. At that moment, Soviet power extends to the west, to the Baltic states and through half of Poland. And the experience of millions of people of Soviet power in certain ways becomes a preparation for the Holocaust.
Talking about the brilliant comparison you made between Denmark and Estonia, you know, two countries at either end of the Baltic with about the same number of Jews and such totally different end of the spectrum results, even though Estonia could have been almost a better place for Jewish life before the war.
The reason why the comparison is important is that it forces us to confront our assumptions. We might think that the Holocaust happened everywhere because the Germans wanted to have it happen everywhere, but in fact, 99% of the Jews who were Danish citizens survive, and about 99% of the Jews in Estonia are killed. We might think the Holocaust happens because local people are anti-Semitic, but there's not much reason to think that there was more anti-Semitism in Estonia than Denmark. Probably, insofar as we can have an idea of these things, there was less. And yet almost all the Jews in Estonia die, and most of the Jews in Denmark survive. So given that you have this enormous contrast, the difference between 1% survival and 99% survival, it seems like you have to ask the question in a different way. And the way that I try to ask it is in terms of the political conditions of occupation. In Denmark, Germany decides from the beginning in 1940 that it's going to preserve the sovereign state and allow most Danish institutions to function normally. In Estonia, you have the radical extreme in the other direction. The state is destroyed entirely by the Soviet Union in 1940. The Soviets declare that Estonia never existed. They make state service in Estonia a crime. The political class is deported to the Gulag or killed outright. And then in 1941, Germany invades Estonia and essentially repeats the process. And that opens up political conditions where the murder of Jews is possible. What's interesting is that by around 1942, when the German leadership is sure that it wants to kill all Jews everywhere, it can't redo history. It can't remake the occupations of France or Denmark so that they're like the occupations of Estonia or Latvia. They have to start from where they are. So decisions about occupation in 1939, or at least as importantly, the presence or absence of an additional Soviet occupation, are what end up being decisive for a lot of the Jews of Europe.
Right. The Nazis are strangely bureaucratic in their way, in that they were happy to kill foreign Jews in France that the French were ready to hand over to them, but they had to have their own home governments sign off on them as well.
Mm-hmm.
This is because of the complexities of foreign policy.
One of my general worries is that the way we think about the Holocaust is itself rather Nazified, and we don't see this. So we think about the Holocaust in terms of race and ethnicity, which were, of course, Nazi categories, and we tend to miss the politics. In this particular case, the Germans were willing to destroy states, and where they did destroy states, then Jews could be murdered in very, very high proportions. But where the Germans did not destroy states, they had to deal with states, and in this sense, they were just one state among other states. They weren't going to murder British Jews or American Jews who happened to be on German territory. They weren't going to murder the Jews of their allies unless their allies specifically allowed them to do so.
Right.
So Romanian Jews were killed by Romanian power, but Romania never sent its Jews to be killed by the Germans. The French authorities wanted to be rid of foreign Jews, and so they sent their foreign Jews to the Germans, but that was a sovereign decision. The Germans were not all-powerful, and their ideas about race were actually limited by the fact of sovereign power in the world.
And because you can pin this down to a kind of lawless void, a special kind of politics, it doesn't take a special kind of person to do it. All these arguments about willing executioners and all the rest. You talk about German cops would go and take part in mass shootings, then go back to, say, Bremen and direct traffic again.
Yeah, there are a couple important things to note here in addition to what you just said. One is that around half, and maybe more, of the murderers in the Holocaust weren't Germans.
That's true.
They were people beyond Germany who simply didn't experience the whole business of the Nazification of Germany, because they just weren't in Germany at the time. So whatever their motives for killing were, we can't explain them by way of Nazi power in Germany from 1933 to 1939.
Right.
The second other thing which is worth noting is that all of the German killers who killed Jews also killed other people. There aren't any German killers of Jews who were, so to speak, specialists. Everybody who killed Jews also killed other people. So if you're going to try to explain it in terms just of anti-Semitism, then you're going to have a hard time explaining why, for example, the Einsatzgruppen also killed communists, also killed the handicapped, also killed Belarusian civilians, also killed Polish civilians. Those things can be explained, of course, but they can't be explained just by way of anti-Semitism. So I think part of the explanation has to be the stateless situation into which Germans were sent. So as you say, police from Bremen, that's a good example, could take part in gathering up 33,761 Jews from Kiev to be murdered over Babi Yar, even though they weren't trained to do anything like this, even though that they didn't know that something like this was going to be their job, and then they could go back to Bremen during the war, after the war, and just behave as normal policemen. And no one, I think, would have known the difference.
No one thinks of Hitler as an ecological thinker. What did you mean by that?
You've isolated in this question the two, as it were, abstract causes that I'm trying to emphasize, state destruction and ecology. I'm in accord with many of my colleagues about the importance of other things, but these two general causes are perhaps a little bit new in my argument.
Right.
Since we have tended to draw the conclusion that the problem with Germany was that it was too strong of a state,
right,
or too big of a state, we have sometimes in practice then drawn the practical conclusion that it would be all right to destroy states. One would want to mention the American invasion of Iraq in 2003, which was also premised on, I think, a more naive idea that destroying states necessarily leads to freedom, because the problem of repression is always the problem of too,
yes,
much state rather than too
very American,
little state.
Yeah.
I think it's fair to say that the Americans who were in favor of that war were hugely optimistic about what happens when you remove the previous political regime.
Right, but there's also the other sort of more pre-war than war feel is the rising tide of refugees. The Mediterranean, I mean, how many have died there in the last couple of years? Thousands have drowned in the Mediterranean, and no one wants refugees. I remember, like, the Canadian situation, none is too many before the war, where a very anti-Semitic bureaucracy did not want to let in Jewish refugees. And it seems to, that resonates almost with the, how anti-illegal immigration has suddenly become the compelling issue in the presidential campaign.
I think that the issue of immigration from the South actually connects both the question of the state and the question of ecology.
Yes.
You're quite right. In the interwar period in Canada and the U.S., and for that matter, almost everywhere in the world, there was very little willingness to offer state recognition to Jews. That's another way of talking about allowing refugees. You have a quota in which you're willing to recognize so many people as having the potential to be your own citizens. If you don't do that, when they're stripped of citizenship, then they have nowhere to go. So the history of the Holocaust is precisely that of the massive stripping of Jews of citizenship, and then they're not having anywhere else to go. The Jews who were killed in the Holocaust had to be first stripped of citizenship. There are almost no exceptions to that. The main way to destroy, to strip Jews of citizenship turned out to be destroying the states of which they were citizens. So when one speaks of refugees, then that is the parallel, that if states are unwilling to recognize these people as potential citizens, then they have nowhere to go. But there's also an ecological side to this, I think, which is that in the European Union today, where immigration from the South is becoming, unfortunately, a very resonant political issue for the far right and the populist right, and in the United States, where, as you say, it's become the major issue so far in the presidential debates, one of the root causes of immigration from the South is precisely climate change.
Yes.
Insofar as Mexico desertifies, insofar as North Africa continues to desertify, you're going to have more and more people who want to come north. That's a root cause. And if we don't address the root cause, or if we forget the root cause, then we're heading down a dangerous spiral.
And we just specialize in building fences. But that is the feel, and also the whole economic feel of the 30s. And as far as statelessness goes, is that not how ISIS prospers? And what happens to the minorities of the Middle East under their control?
Yeah, I mean, ISIS is an example of the spectacular ahistoricity of American political conversation. It's really amazing how little we seem to have learned from 2003. It's pretty obvious that something like ISIS could only arise in a place where the state has been knocked out. We chose to knock out the state in 2003, and unfortunately we still haven't had the political debate which would lead us to understand why that was such a bad idea. Meanwhile, you're absolutely right. ISIS is a good example of how what politics looks like when conventional states, not even good states, they can be bad states, but when conventional states are moved completely out of the way. I don't like authoritarian regimes, right? No. But there is something worse than an authoritarian regime, which is the complete removal of political authority and its replacement by people who are able to organize anarchy,
yeah.
Which is what, I mean, that's what totalitarianism is. We think totalitarianism means a big state. That's not what totalitarianism is. Totalitarianism is the organization of anarchy, the organization of passions, the manipulation of people when there is no normal state to protect them. And unfortunately, that's what we're looking at in ISIS today. I can't help but notice also that the zone where ISIS is functioning is also a zone where an unbelievably hot summer has made normal political action very, very difficult. It's also a place where drought in 2010 seriously disrupted normal political organization. So again, I can't help but think that somewhere in the background there's also an ecological variable at work. And what I see, you know, and what historians always have to work against is the way that historical memory is not about what actually happened. Historical memory is about what's convenient. So
yes.
When we say that the Holocaust in America was all about trains, you know, we're obsessed with trains. We don't have trains. we don't notice that, in fact, more people in the Holocaust were killed by internal combustion engines or by bullets, things that we do have. And bureaucracy is a crucial example. If you blame the Holocaust on bureaucracy, I think you're missing the point entirely. The Holocaust was only possible where the Germans created bureaucracy-free zones. It was only possible where people were separated from bureaucracy. Bureaucracy was actually, in general, a factor which kept people alive. And yes, I mean, I'm making a very big argument in the conclusion, which I'm sure a lot of people aren't going to like, which is that the right and the left are essentially identical in their misanalysis of the Second War and of the Holocaust, that whether you're on the left and you're thinking of some kind of postmodern fragmentation of the state, or whether you're on the right and you're celebrating the domination of the market over the state, you're making the same mistake if you're not taking the state seriously, right. If you're not beginning from the state. Because it's the moment where the state isn't taken seriously, where we lose track of the state, where it falls into the background, where we all may be, as you say, confronted with things which we thought could never happen again.
Well, thank you very much. That was Timothy Snyder, author of The Black Earth.
You've been listening to The Bibliopod for the weekend of August 21st. Find new episodes at macleans.ca and subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, and BeyondPod. The Bibliopod is produced by Sarmishta Subramanian. Theme music is by Stephen Scratt and Asher Lenz. Additional music is by Salman Gatke from his album Under the Red, White, and Blue. Thanks to Anne Lavery and Scott Metcalf. Thanks for listening.